Today's Teisho is on Case 1 in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 1 is entitled, Emperor Wu Asks Bodhidharma. Engo's Introduction. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance, and you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then, whatever situation you may find yourself in, you can enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving. Now tell me, how in fact will this sort of person behave? See Secho's Complications. Main Subject. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, no holiness. Who is this standing before me? Asked the emperor. Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went into the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shinko, who said, do you in fact know who this person is? The emperor said, he told me he was not knowing. Shinko said, this is the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shinko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if all the people went, he would not return. Secho's verse, holy teaching emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me, not knowing? So this is a very famous scene in the history of Buddhism in China, history of Zen in particular. Zen came from India originally. It was brought to India by an Indian monk whose name was Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma. Sometimes in China he's called Dhammo or Putidhammo, Putidhammo. In Japan, he's called Daruma, Daruma. Bodhidharma was probably from South India. And when he was in his 40s, he came to China to bring the Zen school. Already in China, there were many schools of Buddhism. And they were fairly well established. Emperor Wu of Liang was a patron of Buddhism. He was quite impressed by Buddhist teachings, and he attracted large numbers of teachers from India, and they would come to his court and set up temples and sort of like universities, you could say. So Emperor Wu of Liang had a very great interest in Buddhism, and he was producing these beautiful monasteries and research centers, and under his direction, translations were made of Indian texts into Chinese and so on. Bodhidharma was from one particular sect in India, one particular sect of Buddhism. As you may know, there's different kinds of Buddhism all over the world. So if you go to Tibet, there's a kind of Buddhism which is called Lamaism or Vajrayana Buddhism. It's very mystical. It has a lot of symbolism. And if you go into a a Tibetan Buddhist temple, you'll see lots of hanging scrolls and illustrations that show various gods and teacher figures, very bright colors, a lot of ritual. So when the Dalai Lama came here to Rutgers many years ago, a number of monks made a sand painting at the Zimmerli Museum. And usually the sand painting is a big mandala, a big circular representation of the universe. And they actually draw the mandala first, I guess with some kind of chalk or powder, and then they fill in the borders with colored sand. So it's very laborious. They have like a tiny little funnel that they funnel the sand through. And basically there's this very intricate design which has a lot of symbolic importance. They just spent hours and hours and hours and hours dropping little grains of sand into this mandala until this beautiful form takes place. When it's done, it's really exquisite. And making the mandala is thought to be a kind of meditation in itself. If you read the Dalai Lama's teachings or you study Tibetan Buddhism, you know, it has a distinctive approach. If you go to Sri Lanka or Southeast Asia, you will see monks who wear yellow robes and go out begging in the morning, and they sit in meditation quietly observing the moment from moment to moment. And that's a very ancient Buddhist practice, a different kind of Buddhist practice from what the Tibetans do. So what happened was that as the Buddhist teachings evolved in India, you had all these different techniques or methods for helping people get awake, helping people wake up from their illusions. So Tibetan Buddhism really comes out of a particular school of Buddhism in India. And also Theravada, or the Buddhism of South Asia and Southeast Asia, also comes out of India originally. And so did Zen. Basically the Zen school was rather distinct in India because it was quite aware of the workings of the unconscious mind. So Zen is really, really unique because it uses the power of the unconscious mind to help people wake up. If you do Vipassana meditation, you pay a lot of attention to the moment. You learn how to watch what's happening, everything that's happening from moment to moment. The Vipassana method is just to keep paying attention to your awareness, your bodily sensations in particular. So when you're meditating, you're watching the breath, and after you can stabilize your mind by watching the breath, you begin to be able to focus on each sensation. So you might notice that you have pain in your leg, and then you might hear the fan. And then you might feel your bottom on your cushion, and then you feel the pain in your leg again, and then you feel maybe your eyes blinking, and then you hear the fan, and so on. So you just keep noting moment by moment what's happening, what you're aware of, or what you're sensing moment by moment. You try not to think. In Tibetan Buddhism, they have many different practices that are quite complicated. Bodhidharma brought Zen out of India to China, and Zen is the school of Buddhism that believes in the power of the unconscious mind. So sometimes when we are stuck, our unconscious mind can help us. I myself will sometimes be writing, and I'll be working on some project, and I'll be blocked. I won't know where to go next. And sometimes if I go to sleep, when I wake up in the morning, I have the solution. I know what to do. My mind has somehow solved this problem while I was asleep. There are other ways in which the unconscious mind is active all the time. But in Zen, we believe that it's actually closer to enlightenment than the conscious mind. And we believe that you can use meditation practice to open up a door between your unconscious mind and your conscious mind. We really believe that. And it's quite successful. It's been quite successful in history. So anyway, Bodhidharma was a South Indian monk, and he came to China when he was in his 40s, and he went to the court of the Emperor Wu of Liang. And the emperor had been building these beautiful temples and endowing these sort of like research centers, you could say. And he had heard that this very famous meditation master was coming from India. So this is like a great moment in Zen history. And it's in all, everybody who does Zen in East Asia knows about this story. This is very famous. In fact, if you were to go to a Zen temple anywhere in China or anywhere in Japan, you would always see a picture or a statue of Bodhidharma. In this story, the emperor hears that the monk is coming, and you can imagine that he hears this very famous meditation master, like the Dalai Lama, is coming to visit his kingdom, and he's going to have an interview, and he's expecting something really great. We in our world today, if we like Zen, would also imagine that this would be a really exciting opportunity. So here's a great, very famous Zen teacher, and the Emperor of China, and the Zen teacher is trying to, you might think, he's trying to basically present Zen to the Emperor and get the Emperor to go, oh, Zen is wonderful. I would love to support your school, Bodhidharma. We could imagine that Bodhidharma, when he would go to see the emperor, would put on his best robes and wash his face, very carefully, maybe some perfume. And he'd want to make a good impression. How do you do, your majesty? He'd be very smiley and very bright. And when the emperor asked him a question, he would definitely want to please, aim to please the emperor. We grow up, it's very important to be able to have those skills in our society. You need to be able to accommodate the expectations of others. It's a survival skill. So I always tell my students, I sometimes teach very low-level students, like remedial students. And, if they're bored, they really show it, So I'll be talking and I'll look over and their heads are on the desk or they're looking at the sky, and they look like they're about to go to sleep. And I always tell them, look, don't do this, One of the things I tell them is when you're in a class with a professor, you should look like it's the most interesting thing in the world, Even if you're thinking about going to the beach, look like you're interested. And so, they all sit up and they look like they're interested. I'm happy, Okay. So we learn how to do that, right? So anyway, the emperor is waiting for this great meditation master, and we could imagine this encounter where Bodhidharma would really want to sell him on Zen, and the emperor would go, okay, I'll build you a big training center, I'll give you an endowment, and don't worry, all your problems will be solved. But the history of Zen in China begins with a big failure. Bodhidharma goes to see the emperor, and the interview is not a success, we would say. Bodhidharma goes to see the emperor, and he's not prepossessing. He's not like this very handsome charismatic guy, you know. He's, we could imagine maybe he's sort of, you know, old, you know, 45 used to be pretty old in those days. So maybe he looks a bit old. He's sort of worn out looking. Maybe he's, you know, he hasn't been working out at Bally's or, you know, so, you know, not that impressive. And the emperor says, you know, so I've endowed all these temples. I've created all these research centers. You know, I imagine that I have really gotten a lot of merit. That, you know, all my good deeds are really going to pay off in terms of my spiritual future, you know. I've built monasteries. I've built, you know, research centers. Surely I've acquired good karma, right? And my good karma will help me to be successful spiritually, and my kingdom will flourish. And he says, you know, basically, tell me about, you know, holiness. And Bodhidharma says, you know, I'm not really interested, you know, in holiness. And to tell you the truth, you know, you haven't really gotten any, you haven't really gotten any merit at all from doing any of those things. So when the emperor says, how much merit did I get for doing this? He says, none. You know, merit, who cares about merit? Merit's a fantasy. And then he says, well, what about holiness? And Bodhidharma says, I'm not interested in holiness. I'm interested in vast emptiness, in emptiness. See? And the emperor is totally flummoxed. He doesn't know what to say. And he's a little bit maybe annoyed because he's done all this good stuff and he should get some kind of cosmic reward for it. So anyway, you know, maybe you could, we can imagine that they fall silent, and maybe there's a, you know, there's this long silence, and then, well, thank you, Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma leaves, right? And, you know, so this is the interview. It didn't work out. Zen doesn't begin with Bodhidharma making a big impression on the emperor. In fact, Bodhidharma, the interview is a flop. He doesn't get any help from the emperor. He goes away. And he goes up to the up into the mountains. And this koan doesn't tell us this part of the story, but Bodhidharma, after he left the emperor, went up and lived in a cave in a mountain. And for 9 years, he just practiced zazen, seated meditation. And he would go into the cave and sit facing the wall of the cave. Every day, he would cultivate an enlightened mind. And he did that for 9 years. After a number of years, students began to come to the mouth of the cave. And he ultimately had three really good students, three excellent students, two men and one woman. And they're the people who started Zen in China. Now, you know, this is a wonderful story, I think, because so often in life, you know, our plans don't work out. They just don't work out. You know, we as we grow up, we learn to be small, you know. So, when I was a kid, I used to like to go out in the woods and walk in the woods. When I was living in Baltimore, there was a bird sanctuary, and I used to go there every day on the way home from school. I could actually walk by the sanctuary. And I felt so free and harmonious when I would go and walk through the bird sanctuary. It was so lucky that in the middle of this part of Baltimore, there was this lovely forest, basically. And I felt just wonderful. I felt so good. You know, we also used to have recess when I was in school. And And when we would have recess, we would play sports, and usually might be baseball. Usually, you know, the captain, we'd have two kids who were captains of the team, and they would pick up, pick sides. So the two captains would stand in front of the group, and then all the students in our class would be in a big bunch, and the captains would each pick people. So he'd say, one captain would say, I'll take Tommy, and the other captain would say, I'll take Bill. And then the captain would say, I'll take John, and the other captain would say, I'll take Susan. So basically, the captains would choose up their team, and the process would work like this. You know, each captain would want to get the best players possible. So they'd pick the best ones, and then they'd work their way down through the players until they got to the worst players. And actually, I was almost always one of the worst players. And this was because, you know, I wasn't very coordinated when I was a kid. I didn't have really good motor skills. And my father never practiced throwing a baseball with me. So, you know, basically, you know, when I was in the outfield and somebody would hit a fly ball, I would always miss the ball. You know, I didn't know how to get under the ball. And sometimes I wouldn't be under it positioned right, and I'd drop it. Or I had poor motor skills, so I'd reach for it, but I'd miss, you know. So anyway, people would throw me a ball, and I would miss it, you know, and then it would go behind me, and I would have to go chase it, and meanwhile the guy's running to home base. So, you know, I began to have an inferiority complex, you could say, about myself as an athlete. And it really hurt my feelings to always be the person who was last to be picked. So, you know, I began to become a little more fearful in certain ways, and a little bit less happy about myself, you know? I began to think of myself as like a klutz. I'm a klutz, you know, we used to say a spaz, I'm a spaz. So I wasn't really any good at sports, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is a process I think we all go through. You know, we gradually become smaller and smaller, you know. And I can remember, you know, we did have a game coming up. You know, if I knew it was coming up, I would worry about it, you know, like I'd lie awake at night and I would think, I am going to drop the ball, I'm going to miss the ball, or I'm going to strike out. And it would bother me so much. Of course, the more I worried about missing the ball, the more likely I was to miss the ball. It's really, you know, this expression, psyching yourself out. You know, if you miss the ball once, you know, you worry about it. And if you don't practice, what I really needed was somebody to just throw me the ball 1,000 times. Right? But I didn't really know this. I was just a kid. I thought some people had talent, you know, for catching a ball. Maybe there are such people, but I think a lot of people had parents who would just go out there and throw them the ball 1,000 times, and they'd get better at it, you know. But I would lie in bed at night and I'd worry about the game the next day, and I'd think, if I drop the ball again, I will be even more unpopular. People, you know, if you're a kid and you're playing ball and you know, somebody hits the ball, if you catch it, the batter is out and you're the hero. But if you miss it, the batter is not out, you know, and the other kids go, you screwed us again, you know, and some of them are nice about it. And some of them are really hostile, you know. So it puts tremendous pressure on you to catch the ball. You know, so I would worry and worry and worry about catching this ball. And, of course, being so worried, I would not catch it. Or, if you're up at bat, again, you know, the way to be a good hitter of a ball is to just have somebody pitch you the ball 1,000 times. And you get better, you know, with practice people get better, but I didn't know about practice. And nobody told me, just practice at home. You know, I didn't have anybody to practice with. So, you know, basically I would worry about missing the ball when I was pitched the ball, when I'm trying to swing that bat, and I didn't know how to hold the bat, you know, so on. So I'm not trying to get your sympathy. You know, but what happens, we all go through this process, right, where the world becomes smaller and smaller, you know. So you wind up worried about missing a ball, hitting a ball with a stick, you know. You wind up worried about whether you're going to drop a ball or not. You know, I can remember as a kid just thinking, oh, I don't know if I even want to go to school today because I'm going to have to play baseball and I'm going to drop that ball. You know, it would be like all I would think about all day long was the possibility of screwing up in the baseball game. You know, I think this is very human. You know, this is very human. You know, I think we all go through things like this where, you know, our world gets very small. It gets very small. Everything comes down to whether you can catch a ball. Everything comes down to just whether you can hit a ball with a stick or not. You know, this is like an illustration of a child's world. But, you know, adults can be like this or are like this all the time. You know, so a few years ago, I had a friend of mine. And she was much younger than I was. She had just gotten out of, she was just getting out of school, out of her undergraduate program. And her brother was like this, really a genius. I knew her brother also. He was a former student of mine. And he went through some kind of an accelerated program in pre-med. It's like an accelerated pre-med, and in the last year of your undergraduate school, you start medical school. So you get to medical school early, you get through your undergraduate degree early, and so this guy like sailed through all his chemistry courses, A. And he was in my class. I had him in an English class, and he was brilliant. You know, he just did a wonderful job. And he was a very nice guy. And he went to medical school, and he sailed through medical school, and I think he's doing some kind of a post-medical school degree right now. So his sister, you know, just didn't have that ability with chemistry and so on. And you know, when she talked to an academic advisor as she was leaving school, you know, she said, I really want to be a doctor. And the advisor said, you know, I just don't think that's going to work out for you. I don't think you have the grades. And, you know, she went really, I would say, like into like depression. She really became very, very sad and depressed. And it took a while, like a year or two, for her to get out of this funk. You know, and this is just like the baseball game, right? You know, she was a very intelligent, articulate person. She had, you know, had many abilities, right? And she was, you know, she was just, you know, there's so many things she could have done with her life, but all she could see was to be like her brother, to follow her brother's path, and to equal his achievement. And you could see why you might think this way, right? I mean, she admired her brother, she loved her brother. Also, you know, she probably noticed that her parents were very happy with her brother's success, and she wanted them to be happy with her success, and so on, you know. So anyway, you know, when she couldn't do what her brother did, you know, it just made her very sad, very depressed, and she felt, I know she felt like, so what will I do with my life? It's like she had this image of life, you know, it's medical school or what? It's like a wasteland or empty space, you know. And it's either medical school or I'm a failure. Either medical school or my life is over, see. It's just like that kid worried about the ball, you know, catching a ball. Like me, you know, either I'll catch the ball or I should just die. Maybe I'll get hit by a car on the way to school and I won't have to play baseball again, you know. You know, I actually felt that way. It was like, you know, if only I could get hit by a car, all my problems would be over, right? You know, that's very human, don't you think? And she was so sad because she had no options in life, right? I have no options. See, this is what I mean when I say we become small. We become small. You know, again and again in life, you know, we focus on things and we give them meaning, you know. And we usually create a situation in which there's an element of success and there's a possibility of failure, you know. And this can become something large, it can be relatively large, it could be something relatively small, but either way our world can get a lot smaller, right? You know, so, you know, my mother was, you know, didn't really have a lot of opportunities in life. She grew up during the Great Depression. She wasn't able to go to college, but she loved law. She loved the law, and she worked her way up from like a legal secretary to a court reporter. And she was very, very good at this. You know, she really was, people thought she was a really superb court reporter. You know, and then she got married and she had kids, you know. And I know at one point, you know, she would worry about things like, you know, if the floors began to look a little scratched, you know, we lived in an apartment in Baltimore where we had linoleum floors, and my mother worked so hard to make sure they were shiny and bright, you know. And I remember when I was a little kid, you know, she would actually like obsess about whether if the floors were getting scratched, she'd you know, put some more wax on the floor, or, you know. And eventually she realized she had to go back to work. You know, she actually went back to work, and her world got a little bigger again. You know, it was like when she was just running this little apartment. You know, small things like whether the floors look a little scratched became huge, became these big issues. You know, and I think she thought, how did this happen to me? You know, I used to be this very capable court reporter, and now I'm worried about whether my floors are shiny enough. You know, this is just such a human thing. You know, we focus on something, we give it meaning, and, you know, we want it to be quote-unquote successful. But when we do this, we have this power to, like, reduce everything down to one thing. And then the rest of the world sort of disappears, and our world becomes small. And it's sometimes very hard to step out and say, oh, this isn't so important. This isn't such a big deal. This isn't such a big deal, right? The world is vast and wide. You know, why am I worrying about this? You know, and you know, fortunately, my mother, you know, that she kind of figured this out on her own. You know, in Zen we would say her unconscious mind helped her to see this. But you know, she realized, why am I on my knees with a razor blade scraping wax off the linoleum? You know, I need to get out of the house, you know, and have a job and talk to other people and have a cup of coffee with my friends and so on and have a deadline. And you know, that really helped her. She began to work part-time, and I think she got a lot of her self-respect back. And, you know, she was an excellent mother, but, you know, she worried a little too much about the floors. And when she went back to work, she got a job as an administrator, and she did her usual excellent job. You know, so you know, somehow it becomes hard sometimes to step back, and see the bigger picture. You know, and this is very debilitating. You know, I meet people all the time who have all this education and all these skills, and they feel like they have, like all the doors in their lives are closed. It's really, this happens to people all the time, you know. And it happens to all of us. It's a human thing that we have this ability to focus in, and make one thing very, very important. And this allows us to concentrate. It allows us to be very careful. But you know, we forget that the world is vast and wide. And you know, really, this ability to sort of open up or see the bigger picture is really one of the most important things that Zen can give you. You know, you feel trapped. We often feel in our lives trapped. You know, like there's no way out. And there, of course, there's always many ways of responding to events. Sometimes responding creatively or effectively requires us to change, you know. And that's very difficult sometimes. And it's especially difficult to change if we rely on just what we already know. Just what we already know. So, you know, if somebody says, give me a random number, you're not really going to be able to give them a random number. You're trying to pick a random number, but people are not really able to be very open with their discriminating minds, with their ordinary mind. It's hard to be spontaneous, actually, because we tend to just repeat ourselves, right? You know, so, I remember the first time I went to the Grand Canyon, it was pretty amazing, you know. Second time I went to the Grand Canyon, it was okay, you know, but not like the first time. You know, and third time I went to the Grand Canyon, it's like familiar now, you know. It's difficult for us to have a fresh start, You know, so this idea of emptiness is very important, Because when we sit down on the cushion, the first stage of Zen practice is learning how to calm the mind and focus the mind. And watching the breath allows us to create a stable, focused mind. Eventually, you enter a state that is like deep relaxation. And then you're in a state of concentration that is rather like unfocused. You know? And this state of sort of like unfocused ambient awareness is very valuable, you know? When I was a kid, there used to be a game called Where's Waldo? It probably doesn't exist anymore, or there's some computerized version. But it would be pictures in a coloring book, actually. And the picture would be very complicated. It might be a jungle scene, and there would be monkeys swinging in the trees, and there would be fruit, and there would be, you know, zebras or something. And somewhere hidden in this was a face, a human face, Waldo, see. And, you know, the game was to look at this thing and try to find that face hidden in all these details. And, you know, if you're not in the right state of mind, you never find it, right? You know, you never find it. You need to be in sort of like an open, ambient, unfocused awareness. It's just your mind is just sort of going over the picture without trying to see anything. And then suddenly you'll see it, you know. If you're trying too hard to see it, you never see it. You can't free yourself from your conventional way of seeing the details of the picture. So this is a banana leaf. This is a blade of grass. This is a cloud. You know, that's how we conventionally see. If you can just let your mind relax, you suddenly realize that together they make a face. You know, oh my gosh, there's Waldo, see. Well, I think life is like this too. You know, when we're trapped in our familiar ruts, you know, it's very hard to be spontaneous and creative because we just keep looking at the problem in the same way over and over again, you know. It's like when I was lying in my bed as a kid at night, tossing and turning, afraid I was going to miss the ball. You know, I don't know it just never occurred to me that I should practice. You know, it never occurred to me. I just wasn't listening to my big mind, I guess. You know, I just kept obsessively going over the same territory. You know, it's too bad I didn't have like an uncle nearby who would say, "Hey, let me throw you some balls," you know, and then we just spent hours and I would be missing the ball, but finally I'd catch one. And little by little, you know, that hand-eye coordination gets better. And you catch, you catch instead of catching 1 out of 10, you catch 2, then you catch 3. Pretty soon you're getting most of them, right? And then the next day you do it a little bit and, you know, now we know you're building up those neural pathways, you know, those brain synapses are getting developed. But I didn't know about any of this. You know, I just kept obsessing. And that's very destructive, right? Very destructive. So going over the same old territory again and again is not, you know, seeing things the same way doesn't really get you out, you know. It just keeps repeating the problem. So, you know, Zen is all about getting into this sort of unfocused, observing mind that's sort of just going over the whole terrain, you know, and something just will jump out at you. Trusting that process is very difficult for people, you know, very difficult. You know, sometimes people just don't feel they can speak honestly, or they don't allow themselves to be truthful with themselves. This is very common, you know. When you're growing up, you know, your mother might say, "Do you want some vanilla ice cream? Wouldn't that be good?" So what are you supposed to say? I don't know. You say, "Oh, I want mother to like me." "Oh, yeah, vanilla sounds good," you know. When you're a teenager, you, of course, say no. But when you're a kid, when you're a little kid, you're trying to be, you're learning how to be a human being. So you're taking your cues, you know, one of the earliest lessons is you learn you're a boy, don't do this, you're a girl, don't do that, you know. So, you know, if your father says, "Do you want to go play football?" you think, maybe you're thinking no, but you want to please your father. You say, "Sure, football, yes." You know. You know, we, at any rate, in growing up, we begin not to trust ourselves in certain ways. You know. So you know, learning how to sit on the cushion and enter this unfocused ambient consciousness is really very important. You know, it's very important. And actually what happens is when you get into deeper meditation, you know, eventually you get to this state of mind which is not entirely like your ordinary waking consciousness, and it's not sleep. You know, eventually in meditation you get to this place. It's a strange place to be. Your mind isn't crisp and focused. It's a little unfocused, but it's not asleep. It's like, you know, if you go out at night and you sit behind your house, if you have trees or something, or if you live near trees, and you know, the sun is going down, and you go out and you sit down, you just watch the sun setting, you know. The clouds, you know, get darker, the trees get darker. Finally, the trees are like black silhouettes against the last sun of the evening, the last light of the evening, rather. And, you know, if you just keep taking it in and taking it in, you'll notice your mind is really not busy. You're not thinking. You know, you're not asleep, but you're not thinking. Your mind doesn't feel crisp. It feels relaxed, a little empty, a little open. And when you're in that state, you know, you can begin to have access to your deeper self. Your deeper mind, you know, you could say your unconscious mind. In that half-waking, half-dreaming state, you can stumble into how you really feel or what you really want. You know, when you can't always be honest with yourself about it otherwise, you know. So eventually, if you keep meditating, you know, your mind eventually becomes blank, perfectly blank. That may not have happened to you yet, but if you keep watching the breath, you'll notice at the very end of your breath, your mind becomes just blank for maybe a split second. But eventually that blankness becomes longer or larger. We Zen people put a lot of emphasis on getting to that place. We call that blankness mu, which means emptiness in Japanese, or wu. Wu, it means emptiness in Chinese, in Mandarin. That blankness, it was called shunyata in India. It means empty, zeroness. But zeroness is very liberating. You know, you get to that blank place and suddenly you can be very open. You know, how you really feel can become more clear. And you process information in a different way. It's like having that ambient, open, observing mind allows us to experience things in a very different way, in a very liberating way. So, you know, when Bodhidharma went to see the emperor of China, the emperor was really asking him about, the essence of Buddhism. And Bodhidharma could have said, yes, do good deeds, you know, build temples, and you will get a lot of merit. He could have said that. But if he had said that, he wouldn't really be pointing to the essence of Zen. Right? The essence of Zen is not about success or failure. It's not about winning or losing. It's not about whether you catch the ball or you don't catch the ball. It's really about being open, seeing in a bigger way, you know, in a bigger way. And, you know, and that's the most liberating thing, I believe, is being able to step outside of, you know, suddenly you realize, oh, this isn't a problem. You know, it's a problem at a certain, you know, it's like if you focus in close, something seems like an insurmountable problem. And then, you know, if you step away, you suddenly realize this isn't much of a problem. You know, it's just not much of a problem. It's like not being able to sleep at night because you don't know whether you should buy a Ford or a Chevrolet, you know. If you can get to work, and if you have a car that'll get you to work, you know, what's the problem, right? And there isn't one. But we get caught up in these small details. And you know, let's face it, they don't seem small, right? At certain times they seem so big. You know, when I was a kid, this whole baseball thing, it was just so big, it ruined my life. Really, I mean, I'm not kidding. Probably I would have been happy to be hit by a car, you know. Thank God I didn't throw myself in front of a car or something, because, you know, after a while I just thought, I wasn't really interested in baseball, you know, actually, you know. So who cares if I can catch a baseball? I'm interested in other things, you know. You know, we all go through that, you know, where we just think this is an insurmountable problem, you know, but somehow we just go on living. You know, if we can step outside that box and see the bigger picture, it's so liberating, you know. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" Bodhidharma said, "I'm not interested in holiness, emptiness." "Who is this standing before me?" asked the emperor. I don't know, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shinko, his assistant, who said, "Do you, Your Majesty, know who that person was?" And the emperor said, "He said he didn't know." Shinko said, "Believe it or not, that was a human manifestation of the Bodhisattva of compassion, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal." The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shinko said, "Look, you know, he's not coming back. Even if all the people went, he wouldn't return." So, Secho's verse, the holy teaching, emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? I don't know. Inevitable. The thorns and briars springing up. Secretly by night he crossed the river. All the people could not bring him back. Now, so many years gone by, still Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. The master looks around. Is the patriarch here? Yes, bring him to me, and he can wash my feet. So, you know, the emperor didn't get to meet Bodhidharma. It didn't go well. You know, maybe the emperor lay asleep at night, tossing and turning and thinking, oh my God, he was the greatest Buddhist teacher, and I blew it, you know. And this poem is really saying, quit worrying about it, you know. That was yesterday. You have to meet another Bodhidharma today. You know, be open.